One thing that we have, I said, we are a small cog in the wheel of pesticide testing for food safety. And the U.S. food supply is amazingly safe. When you look at the USDA runs their pesticide data program, where they just go in and buy stuff off the shelves, and then they analyze for, I don't remember the number of pesticides, it's a high number. And they have over 99% of everything that they test that comes in below allowable residue levels. And it's like these growers get an A++ on their grade as far as pesticides they put on versus residues that they find. And when you look at these long-term studies that some people have found, there's no relation between, say, pesticide use and bad health outcomes.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Brian Arnell, and I'm coming to you from the campus of Oklahoma State University. Today, excited to have on Dr. Jeff Miller, Principal Field Investigator and President, Miller Research, LLC. Jeff was raised on a research farm in southern Idaho, where he earned his BS degree in botany and biotechnology from BYU, and then moved on for a PhD in plant pathology from Washington State University, working on potato blight. Jeff worked for 2 years at the University of Minnesota and 6 years at the University of Idaho in Aberdeen as a potato pathologist, conducting research on diseases important potatoes. Jeff now runs his own private research business in southern Idaho, Miller Research, where he conducts research on crop production pest management. Jeff also currently serves on the executive board of the Potato Association of America. Jeff, thanks for joining us today on the Crop Science Podcast Show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Brian.
So give a little bit, I kind of ran through your bio, but provide our listeners with a little bit of the paths. I guess I gave your pathway, but the decisions to follow the pathway as a plant pathologist and then into a private researcher.
Sure. Well, I grew up working on a farm. My father, he was a farmer. We had about 1,000 acres of potatoes, sugar beets, and some small grain. But he also did research on the side. My father had gotten actually a PhD in plant pathology and had gone through the academic route. He actually got a job at Ohio State University as a vegetable pathologist. And then when his father retired from farming, he offered his son the job, So my dad, he said, I'd rather farm than be in academia. So he came back and farmed. And when he did, some of his previous scientists or professors that he worked with said, hey, you've got this great location to do research, you know, better than us. So he would provide on-farm research for some of the work that was being done. It was actually University of California, Berkeley, where he made his first connections there. And as that word got out, the farmers in the area said, well, hey, you're a scientific type guy. Maybe you can test stuff for us. We're being told, you know, this is in the 70s. He says, we're being told to use these fertilizers, these pesticides, and we'd like to know if they work. You know, the university gives us some of that information, but there's a lot more we could know. So he's farming and he starts to do this research on the side and just grew and grew. And I kind of follow the same path. I grew up working on the farm. I was kind of the shovel end of the research, which really wasn't a lot of fun. I want to be in the clipboard into the research because that looks like you're having, you know, a better time. You're up there making notes while I'm digging through the dirt.
You're the grad student. He was the prof.
Exactly. And so I went through the academic route. I got a job as assistant professor and I enjoyed it immensely. But then the same thing happened. He said he was ready to retire. And I thought, you know, I do think I want to try to run my own business. And so that's how I got here.
So tell us a little bit about the work and what you guys are doing on with Miller Research. You know, who are your clientele and what kind of projects you're working on that you're allowed to?
Yo, sure. If I was being very crude or crass about it, I'd say, you know, we're like mercenary researchers. Researchers for hire. So companies, they may have an objective. And you know, so we work for companies like Syngenta, Bayer, BASF. But also some very small companies, some that are very local. They may come and they say, hey, we've got an idea. We want to see if we've got a new fertilizer or a new pesticide, and we want to see how it works. the larger companies, we're often bidding on jobs to, or bidding on opportunities to do research for, say, crop safety. And these are things that are run through like the EPA overseen test. It's about product labeling and or residue tests. So we run a wide gamut of that. Occasionally we get hired by local farmers when things really go south on them. Like for instance, you may have the railroad sprays, the railroad tracks drifts onto the farm. And so the growers will call us and say, hey, we need you to come out and give us an estimate of what the damage is that we've suffered. And so we've worked with a lot of different insurance agencies for years. Occasionally it gets messy. We get to court and we serve as expert witnesses. But most of what we do is our research. We actually are able to do our own research projects, too, that we get funded through the grower organizations. And so we've received funding from the Northwest Potato Research Consortium. It's a group of Idaho, Washington, Oregon. And we also get money from the Snake River Sugar Organizations. We work, do a little bit of work on sugar beets.
So I was about to say, so primarily potato, but you have some sugar beet work going on. Any other crops that you guys have on site?
Yeah, when it comes to, like, say, pesticide registration, you'll see these little patches out there of canola and carrots and peas and beans. But though that's pretty rare. We don't do a lot of that. Most of what we do is potatoes and sugar beets and a little bit of small grains. We also do a little bit of dry bean work from time to time.
So I'm kind of intrigued with this because you do have that academic background. You know, if I look at myself as a state specialist, extension specialist, I do contract work, right? I do work with Nutrien or OCP or whoever doing contract work. I'm always conscious about the protocols though that I'm running. And oftentimes groups and I have to go back and forth to agree on a protocol because I may not feel like there's a good enough check or anything, especially if they're tying my name to it, because a lot of this will come out with my name associated. Is there much of that back and forth on your side, or is it that, you know, the protocols fit in and you're performing it? I'm kind of curious on the private side how that works.
That, you brought up a really good point, Brian. We are very similar to what you do. There's a lot of back and forth on that. So when we work with larger companies, a lot of times they have enough expertise that when they brought their protocol, it's usually pretty well set. But even then, we may look and say, hey, the evaluations you're looking for don't make sense. Or, you know, they'll try to write a protocol that they want to, they go across the nation. And what might make sense in, say, Wisconsin doesn't make sense in Idaho. Like for instance, disease pressure is very different. So like for our potato grower here in Southern Idaho, he or she is probably going to spray four fungicides during the growing season. And that's really a kind of a high-end number. Back to the Midwest, they're going to be spraying 15, 16 times. So sometimes we have to go and say, listen, what you want to do doesn't make sense for our area. And so actually during the spring, a big part of the work we do is going back and forth and trying to get a good protocol. Because I agree with you. I should back up and say, my father worked very hard to say, and he's always taught me, you never, ever skew the results based on who's paying the bill. You have to be completely honest. The minute, as a private company, the minute that we get, you know, we let our results be shaded by the sponsor, the growers don't need us anymore. You know, they say, you have no value for us. We rely on you because you are unbiased. And so, like you said, if my name is going to be attached to it, I want to make sure it's a good trial. We have a good check. We are making the right observations, the right evaluations.
I'm kind of curious because you know, I work in the grains and forages more so, but primarily grains, wheat, corn, soy, and that. When it comes to replicated potato work, I know the size of plots that I have. I'm working anything, let's say corn, anything from 4-row to 8-row, 30 to 40 foot long. What size of plots are needed to do potato? And I'm just thinking of the digging and some of that movement and soil movement. What's plot sizes on a potato research program look like?
Yeah, so for potatoes, we go with a standard 4-row wide plot, and usually we use the first and the fourth row as a buffer, and then we try not to take any data out of that. Everything comes out of the center two rows. For many things, we are going 30 to 35 feet long, and most of the time, at the end of the day, the yield and the quality of the crop is the most important indicator. So we have a commercial harvester, which is two rows, which we've adapted that we can, it'll go in and we can harvest the entire center two rows. And as it goes through, we have like a sliding basket that's able to pull out a subsample that we can use a quality evaluation on. We'll harvest the entire width of those two plot, those two plot rows. And, you know, there are times that we have to go bigger, especially if we're, you know, fumigation research is something that's pretty big right now. And when I'm running a fumigation rig through the field, you know, the rig itself may be 45 feet long. And so I have to put these, you know, I have to have my plot and I have to have these buffers on each side of the plot, and they become quite large. Mm-hmm. We have 3 40 acre fields, and we rotate the potatoes through that. So when we're on that 40 acre piece, we're all potatoes, but we do roughly about 30 acres worth of research on that. And the rest we just plant to.
I haven't thought about that. You're talking about subsamples. And I mean, for me, I get wheat is a little bit intensive because we might look at bacon meal, but I can't imagine the analysis that can be done on a potato crop to look at quality and all the end use characteristics. What are some of the things you look for in a potato crop? And are you doing that, or are you sending it off to a third party or the company that's sponsoring?
You know, both. Some things we're able to do in-house. Others we have to go to a third-party lab. Like for potatoes, a lot of times they'll want to know what's the specific gravity or what's the solid content of the potato. They may want to know because of the fertilizer I use, have I affected the nutrient concentration? Some people want to know what the French fry color is or how it'll affect the potato chips. So there are a lot of different post-harvest tests that can be done to say, you know, how good is this potato that we've made?
I'm just going through all the things. So I guess moving back to some of the private, you know, I've looked at some of the regions in Oklahoma, and it's actually the region that's doing sweet potato. Some of the farmers there have made a conscious effort where they understood that they either had to expand or specialize. Is that almost similar to, could you be farming on the type of ground you have and that's enough of a farm? Or is this one of those things where you had if you either expand to do just traditional farming, or you're able to do the research on a smaller unit area? Would that be fitting?
Yeah, so yeah, actually, this is what my father went through back in 2002. You know, he was farming, he was doing research, and I see about 1,000 acres, and he came to the conclusion. He says, "I can't farm on that. I can't make it work. And there's enough research to do that. I'm going to specialize and go one way or the other." And we often see that with the larger growers that are around us. And this gets to, you know, I'll hear people sometimes in social media, they'll knock these, what they call these corporate farms. But, you know, some of these large potato farms here in Southern Idaho, they're run by families. And it's true. They have a huge payroll. They may have 200 people on their payroll that they're using to run their operation. But at the end of the day, it's a family that started it. And quite honestly, as much as the general public may not like that, the economics drive that. And a potato grower, my dad was growing about 100 acres of potatoes. And he said, "I could never survive today. There's just no way."
Many in the private research sector that are doing potatoes, you know, I think most of the private research groups I know, that they're all heavy corn, because that seems where a lot of money is. But are there a lot of private researchers in the potato sector?
Not too many. I mean, here in Idaho, we actually have, I think there's 6 different private research firms right in Idaho. And every one of them does some work with potatoes, at least a little bit. There are a few others. There's a one that's Rob Schaefer has Mid-Michigan Agronomy, I think, and he's quite – there's one in Manitoba, Gaia Research, that's quite I guess they not only do they do just the contracted private research stuff, but they also do a little bit of education outside of that and interfacing with the growers. So I would say there's not a whole lot, though. If you do look – like the National Alliance of Independent Crop Consultants, that organization has all these private researchers in it. And the number that work in potatoes isn't great.
Moving on to some of the other broad, the topics that we can discuss is, you know, you do a lot of IPM work. Can you, and you're doing IPM work within a food stuff, right? a direct to plate kind of thing. So can you talk about the work that you do and the importance of understanding IPM management in a food crop like a potato?
I give a presentation and I have a picture of a bumper sticker that says, "I love pesticides." And I'll tell the audience, I said, "I've never seen this. And I don't think you ever will, unless you see someone who works for a chemical company." You know, the general feeling is there's this dislike of synthetic pesticides. And yet, if you look through history, what they've allowed us to do is it's truly, I believe it's probably one of the greatest miracles of science, especially when you look at an airplane flies over a field going 250 miles an hour. It's releasing basically the amount, a soda pop can full of product over an acre. And you get great disease control. It really is miraculous. And as I work with people, I say, you know, growers are to the point now today where they don't want to spend any money they don't have to. And I tell the audience, now, I really should really think about that, because oftentimes I hear, oh, these guys are out there spraying stuff they don't need to spray. They're just wasting. You know, they're growers are not. They analyze every penny that's going to go out the door. And they say, if I'm going to make this pesticide application, it better return money for me. And so I think the science has progressed very well. We can say, we're going to use the right pesticide. It's almost like the four R's with fertilization. It's almost pesticide. We want the right product in the right place, the right time, and the right rate. And I really do see that it's almost like, you know, the growers, they go to the doctor. They go to the plant doctor, whether it be at the university or someone private who they trust, and they say, here's the issue. How do I best treat this potential disease? And so I do believe that growers are working very hard to minimize the amount of pesticide they put on, but they are tools that are necessary.
For the region, what's it cost per pass for either a ground rig or aerial applicator? What's it costing your folks to do that?
So if we're dealing with the foliar blights are usually the diseases that growers are sprayed for the most. And the cheapest fungicide you can buy that's going to be good is probably going to be about $5 an acre. And you may spend up as much as $30 an acre. So you have that $5 to $30 range. If you're going to fly an airplane in our area, it's probably going to cost you about $15 an acre. So let's say you go to the cheap fungicide with the airplane, you spent $20 an acre. And, you know, when I talk to audiences about this, I say, so if I got a 100-acre pivot, I have just spent $2,000 just from just out of the gate. Okay. And so this is not a decision I'm just going to make lightly whether I'm going to do this. Ground rigs, they may cost a little bit less, but the potato world, people don't like to use ground rigs because they go and they actually compact the soil. They make where those tire tracks are. They make a nice microenvironment for disease to start.
Oh, that makes sense. So I was thinking ground rigs would be essential due to volume, because there's likely some of the products need a little bit more volume flow. But I didn't even think about the compaction. Now you have this spot that's going to hold moisture and create a microclimate of disease.
There are some areas like we have a Native American reservation, and they don't allow airplanes to fly. And so in those places, the growers will use a ground rig. If we go back 20 years, a lot of people used chemigation, and they would run it through. Actually, a big part of the work that we did with the potato growers was comparing these application methods to see how effective they were. If you're chemigating and you're doing it, you know, exactly the way that the state lines up, you're probably only spending maybe $250 an acre for your application cost in addition to your product cost. The problem with that is, though, is the farms have gotten larger and larger. They say, it's just too much work. I'm willing to pay the extra to have the airplane just come. It's done like that.
Can you describe what chemigation looks like for you guys, for those that aren't aware of it on the podcast?
Yeah, so most of our, every potato we grow is irrigated. And most of them are under a pivot irrigation. So somewhere, wherever, we have a fair amount of water that's coming from the deep aquifer system and some that's come from the surface system. But regardless of what that source is, wherever the pump is, past the pump, there'll usually be some kind of injection point. So they may have a large tank, and usually they're paying a service company to fill it up. They'll call and say, hey, I need fungicide X. And they'll come and they'll bring it, put it in the tank. And they'll calibrate that injection stream so it's injecting so much per minute, and they know what their flow water flow is out the pivot or out the line. And that's what it looks like. They'll try to make that pivot go around as fast as they can, so they're putting the least amount of water, but still they're putting on about 4,000 gallons an acre.
That's what I was about to ask. It seems like a lot of volume for something like a fungicide.
It is. You know, they'll usually refer to in inches. They'll try to put on, say, 1/15 of an inch to 2/10 of an inch. That's the usually the fastest they can go. And, you know, there actually was big debates in the potato world about how chemigation was a waste of time because you wash too much of it off the leaves. And it is true, you get lower residues on your plant leaves, but you also get better coverage throughout the entire canopy, especially as that canopy gets mature. So you end up having very similar efficacy, say, with a chemigation versus a plane flying over the field.
That's fascinating. So beyond the economics of running a fungicide or an insecticide, what are the other attitudes? You know, what's the producer's take on it? What are they want to reduce the amount of insecticides and pesticides used, just an overarching theme, or talk about the producer attitude?
I think they do. Most of them, and we even have growers who will, I guess, almost you say they gamble. And a lot of them will say, you know, I do think I can get by without, say, an insecticide or a fungicide spray. And so you'll see growers cut, especially when margins get tight. You know, as far as one thing that worries me, I see buyers like, say, some of these potato buyers. I'm going to use McCain as an example, and I don't mean to impugn them. Just they have come out with what they call regenerative ag program. And so they're telling growers, you know, we want you to be a regenerative ag grower. And to do that, we want to shoot for certain reductions. You know, we'd like to see you reduce a certain amount of maybe it's pesticide use. Now, while I think that's a noble idea, and I understand where they're coming from, at some point you get to the point where I'm using what I need to raise a good crop. And so cutting just to cut, I think, is a bad idea. If you're saying I'm going to cut to meet an IPM program, that makes sense. But if you're saying, hey, I just want to see you reduce your AI on the crop by a certain amount, to me, that doesn't make sense because you may have a grower who has optimized their situation already and they're saying I there's no more room to cut.
So is it that this, you know, their approach to this is more theoretical and more social, or is there some data that says that the residues are high in the U.S. food industry?
Oh boy, I'm going to emphasize, Brian, this is my personal opinion. It is really theoretical. One thing that we have, I said, we are a small cog in the wheel of pesticide testing for food safety, and the U.S. food supply is amazingly safe. When you look at the USDA runs their pesticide data program where they just go in and buy stuff off the shelves, and then they analyze for I don't remember the number of pesticides. It's a high number, and they have over 99% of everything that they test that comes in below allowable residue levels. And it's like these girls get an A++ on their grade as far as pesticides they put on versus residues that they find. And when you look at these long-term studies that some people have found, there's no relation between, say, pesticide use and bad health outcomes. There's a lot of correlations that get drawn at times, but a lot of times you can find confounding factors there. The food supply that we produce, the pesticides we use are done in a safe manner so that we don't have these bad residues on our food.
So speaking of probably the most well-known pesticide out there, what's the take on glyphosate or Roundup? You know, how bad is it?
You know, glyphosate is actually very, very safe pesticide, herbicide. It's a miracle. It's like a miracle drug for what it can do. And of course, it has limitations and it has to be used properly. But I really do feel it's we've been as a nation affected by ambulance chasers. There are some lawyers out there who said, hey, this is a great way for us to make some money. Because after all, nobody loves pesticides. So if I can get in a courtroom and say, look at this bad pesticide, and if you try to stand up and defend it, doesn't come off looking very well. And some of these defendants, they are suffering from very real problems. The issue is, though, there's been no science to show that the use of Roundup is linked to the problems that they've stated. None at all. And I think that's a problem, because if we get to the point where, say, Bayer decides, hey, we can't afford to fight this, we need to pull it, I would imagine that they'll go after 2,4-D or something else will come up on the legal radar.
Oh, absolutely. And not to mention what kind of challenge some of our crop production would be to take a chemistry such as glyphosate off of the tool belt. I mean, we ought to be mixing, we ought to be, doing rotation of chemical rotation and crop rotation, but just to lose glyphosate as that tool within the tool belt would be really hard to make some of the stuff go.
Yeah, there's been work that showed how when we've been able to switch to Roundup-ready crops, the if we want to look at the amount of active ingredient we're putting per acre, it has gone down substantially because we use a lot less active with Roundup. And the things that Roundup has replaced were more toxic. They were more harmful to the environment. And so if they take that away and they push us back, it would be a huge step backwards.
It's time for our famous three.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Absolutely. Well, Jeff, we're reaching the end of our time, so I'm going to go into our three questions I always ask our guests, and we're going to lead with, what's been a good work resource for you?
People like you at the university, having a good group of colleagues that you can pick up the phone and talk to. I think, as good as the internet is, as good as, say, ChatGPT is, you can't beat the experience that of people who've worked in agriculture, and whether not just in the academia, but also, say, in the service industry. I've got field men who've been out there for 40 years who've seen about everything. And having this ring of people that I can call and say, hey, what can you tell me? That's just unbeatable.
Now, what do we do? You got a lot going on, running the business there. If they go, what do you do in your free time?
So my wife and I have four sons. Three of them are out of the house. We still have one left. And so usually whatever it is they like to do. And I just to spend time with my family. If I don't have to be here at work, I want to be with them.
100%. Finally, where do people go to find out more about Miller Research?
We have a website at millerresearch.com, and we also have a little YouTube channel where we actually try to show some of the methods that we use in our research. And we put together just a few brief little informational things about some of the potato diseases that we work on. And so you can find us at Miller Research under YouTube.
Fantastic. Well, folks, that wraps up another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Thanks for joining us today with our guest, Dr. Jeff Miller, Principal Field Investigator and President of Miller Research, LLC. Remember, hit that subscribe button if you want to get notifications every time we drop a new podcast, and also share this video with your friends and colleagues if you learned something new today. And feel free to leave us comments if you have suggestions for new guests or questions for previous guests. Jeff, I always enjoy it. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.